LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. And today I'm very excited to have as my guest Colson Whitehead, whose new book, The Underground Railroad, really is the talk of literary America. I'm going to read a quote from the Boston Globe Review, which says, "The first thing to say about Colson Whitehead's new novel, The Underground Railroad, is that it's really good. Good, in fact, in just about every way a novel can be good. A fully realized masterpiece, a weird blend of history and fantasy that will have critics rightfully making comparisons to Toni Morrison and Gabriel Garcia Marquez." Well, you know, you've got, chosen by the Oprah Winfrey Book Club, one of our rare occasions, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, has named it as being on his summer reading list. Many writers are afraid of, or even have a certain amount of cynicism about, attempting to write, forget the great American novel, a great American novel. Was that on your mind?
I was trying to, do what I usually do and just do the best I can. I think my last book was about the World Series of Poker, and it has a lot of jokes. For me, it's a humor book about the World Series of Poker. And having got all the jokes out of my system, I think I was ready to take on something serious. And then as I did research, I realized that some of my, some of the satire I usually do wouldn't work. Thinking about what my great-great-great-grandparents went through when they came to America as slaves. I wanted to do justice to their memories and all the slave dead. And so I tried to make the plantation as realistic as possible, have the psychology as real as I could pull off, just to honor them. The book takes off into different areas of the fantastic, but I wanted that first section to be as realistic as I could pull off, to do justice to what actually happened.
Yes, the book is called The Underground Railroad, and its premise is that this is an actual railroad with cars and locomotive and tracks and station masters, and that it runs underground. Now, all of us, when we're children, I know that when I first heard the term Pulitzer Prize, I thought it was a surprise, the Pulitzer Prize. Or I thought the State of the Union message, I kept waiting for the president to announce it. The State of the Union this year is New Jersey for cleaner water. So we all take, when we're children, the aspects of our history and literalize them. This takes the idea of the Underground Railroad and builds an underground railroad. Were you on safe terrain there?
Well, I've had, fantastic elements, in some of my books. What if the Underground Railroad was an actual railroad is more of a premise, and there's not much there to work with. And, when I first came up with the idea 16 years ago, pretty quickly I came up with, and what if every state that our protagonist goes through as he moves north, and originally the protagonist was male, South Carolina, North Carolina, is a different state of American possibility, in that kind of Gulliver's Travels type way, where the book is being rebooted every 60 pages as a new island of America is discovered. And making that decision allowed me to play with time and history and move different historical details around to fit my idea of what I wanted Cora to go through.
Yes, there's a moment in certain novels when you just, you know, grab your breath, and in the Underground Railroad, it's when we realize there they are, underground, and a railroad train draws up, and suddenly the book can take these characters, Cora and Caesar, anywhere. We don't know where they're going to go. We don't know where they're going to be. And one of the biggest surprises in the book is that you don't use that freedom indiscriminately. This is not really Gulliver's Travels. These are hypothetical but possible and likely Americas that they visit.
Yeah, what might have happened? You know, like Oregon was founded originally as a white separatist state. People who wanted to flee, black people in the South, moved west. And for decades, black Americans were not actually allowed to live in the state of Oregon. And that became, you know, that sort of informed the North Carolina chapter, which is a white supremacist state with echoes of the Holocaust.
I found myself feeling often ashamed of not just that chapter of American history, but this ongoing chapter of American history. It's a book that asks everyone who reads it to think about what human beings are capable of and why they become capable of these things, huh?
Well, I mean, you know, that there are times when I would describe a lynching and think, am I going too over the top? It's like every Friday this town has a lynching of a black person they've caught because black folks aren't allowed in this fantastic North Carolina. And then I would go back to my books and realize, no, actually, this actually happened. Lynchings were public spectacles where you would bring your children to watch a black man being hanged or burned alive. You would take photographs to make postcards that you can, you know, send to your friends. I had a great time at so-and-so's lynching. And so if you listen to, you know, some of the rhetoric at a Trump campaign that's so anti-Mexican, anti-woman, anti-Muslim, and anti-human, you realize that you don't have to, you know, you don't have to go too far to find these vectors of hate. They're still around us.
Not just still around us, they're eternally present. Weekends were spent in the 18th century visiting insane asylums because the people there were so entertaining to see as they gibbered. This is not uncommon. This is a human impulse and a horrifying one.
Yeah, and you don't have to go very far to find it enacted.
No, in our present tense, watching the campaign, watching the names being called and the mud being hurled. This is a book, Underground Railroad, by my guest, Colson Whitehead, that probably uses the N-word as frequently as the other great American novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And it also uses an expression that comes from Huckleberry Finn. The characters talk about lighting out for the West, the way Huckleberry does at the end of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Were you fitting your book into the scheme of great American fiction?
Well, yeah, again, it's trying to do a good job. I mean, it's, you know, the story of a slave's escape is an adventure tale. Will he or she make it to the North? You're being pursued. You're being betrayed. And so, you know, I've written books with not much of a plot. Sag Harbor is a, you know, portrait of a summer, a kid growing up in the 1980s, and is a series of episodes sort of strung together, hopefully unified by the character's voice. But there's, yeah, there's definite drama in the story of a slave's escape, and that's there in Huckleberry Finn. It's a great structure to play with, you know, as someone who has written books that are plot heavy and books that aren't plot heavy. Figuring out what works in terms of the reader's expectations, what is a natural misadventure for Cora as she moves north? What kind of adventures illuminate different corners of American history? I was trying to keep it matter of fact in the way that the slave narratives I use as research are very matter of fact. They're describing atrocities, their life in a plantation, without drama. You know, all the day-to-day brutalities were routine. And so if I can take the fantastic elements and weave them into a realistic matter-of-fact voice, it seemed that'd be a way of keeping the fabulism on a very low setting.
We see, as Cora travels from state of mind to state of mind, from possibility to possibility, is that the imagination doesn't really know what freedom is. And the places she finds as she comes up into what looks at first like a wonderland, it's sort of like the section in The Grapes of Wrath, when the Jodes find a place where they can clean, where they have meals that are expected and served to them, where they're treated like human beings. So it seems when they get to South Carolina, but in fact it's a paternal estate. The people are hoping to study the Negro, if necessary, to sterilize the Negro, to create a control over what's possible, to redefine what a black person is according to strictures that feel safe to the white paternalistic society. Do I have that right?
That's about right. I mean, I was drawing, you know, I am collapsing time, and so it seemed exploring the social programs of the Great Society and importing them into a slave time zone. I could get interesting friction from what we think as a progressive modern idea of social uplift and importing it into this slave economy.
One of the book's themes, it seems to me, is that things are always misnamed. It's not just that the slaves are given new and different names that they have to keep remembering or they'll get caught. There's a section toward the end, and I have to tell my listeners that the last 15 pages of this book are unforgettably good. It begins with a narrative from the point of view of the protagonist's mother, Mabel, incredibly beautifully done. Then we go up north, and a woman, a descendant of the events in this book, says that she's surprised that that world war in Europe is being called the Great War, because the Great War was always the war between the blacks and the whites, and always will be. Now, we sitting there say, the Civil War, the war between the states. No, she says, the war between the blacks and the whites. And we never gave it that name, huh?
No, and it's, you know, I was still waging now.
Absolutely. To what extent did Black Lives Matter enter the frame of your construction of this book?
I think that's sort of a natural question because of the timing. For me, the questions raised by Ferguson 2 years ago and the rise of Black Lives Matter. It's nothing particularly new to me. I grew up in New York in the 80s when young black males were being killed by police. We hear about the talk that parents give to their kids about how to act with police or how to conduct yourselves when you're pulled over. And of course, I got that. Richard Pryor has a great bit from the early 70s about being pulled over and not making sudden movements, like, I am reaching into my glove compartment, don't shoot me. So that was an early lesson I got. And so I think we have these periodic eruptions where we want to talk about race. And I think they're occasioned by technology. In the 50s, people saw black Americans being beaten and shot with fire hoses as they were protesting civil rights on television. And that made a new conversation about race. videotape technology in the early 90s captured Rodney King being beaten. And for a while, we talked about it. And now the rise of the cell phone where and the convenience store security camera capturing police brutality allows us to talk about race in a serious way. But, you know, I guess from my point of view, we talk about it for a couple of years and then forget about it. And I think that's sort of the American process.
You say that you know about post-traumatic stress disease and that one of the things that becomes central to the Underground Railroad is that these people have been subjected to so much torture, stress, fear, dehumanization, that we have a heroine who basically can't stand to be touched. She can't stand to be whirled around when she's dancing. She's been raped. She's been beaten. And that she barely has a chance to consolidate her human experience and move forward.
You do research and realize the particular state of black womanhood in slavery. When you hit puberty, you're expected to squeeze out more slaves. More slaves means more hands to pick more cotton. More cotton means more money. You're breeding stock. You're also a worker. From my remove, I can think about what trauma does to a person. And we have this conversation about PTSD, but they're not post anything. The trauma they're experiencing from sunup to sundown. And how do you create a realistic psychology for the plantation? How do you create a convincing protagonist who comes out of that and can move towards some kind of sense of self into her core-ness, I guess, as I call it when I was writing it? When she steps off the plantation, she has no idea what freedom is. She has no idea what is off of the outside the boundary. And she's making herself, you know, state by state, word by word. There's a big section in every slave narrative where the slave learns how to read. You know, you were forbidden to learn your letters when you're a slave. If you taught your slave how to read, you could be beaten or jailed, fined. And so she learns how to read. She learns about the world. She studies almanacs and gains a knowledge of how things work.
Her lover gives her an almanac, next year's almanac. It's like word from the future, and she's the first person to ever open the book. It crackles, and she feels, oh, I've never been the first one to open a book before. It's a real moment in her selfhood to own something that is completely new and completely hers.
You know, as a child of the civil rights movement, I take for granted what my parents fought for and my parents' parents. You know, part of the book is exploring what has and what hasn't changed, and it probably lands on not much has changed at all. But we can read. We can be presidents. You know, I think, the progress is quite slow and incremental, but we do sort of plod along and we do sort of slowly crawl to some sort of semi-decent future, inch by inch.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW and the Radio Foundation in New York, where I'm speaking with my guest, Colson Whitehead, about his book, The Underground Railroad, an extraordinary book. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Colson Whitehead about his latest book, The Underground Railroad, about an outcast on the run who finds herself on a real underground railroad that travels through time as well as space. Now, you found a treasure trove of evidence and material. Apparently, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in setting up the Writers' Project, had people interviewing the survivors of slavery. How many such interviews exist?
There are hundreds and hundreds, and I'm sure the writers in the midst of the Great Depression were glad for the work. And so, yeah, there are 80-year-old, 90-year-old people who were children or teenagers at the time of the Civil War. And some of the accounts are just a paragraph. Some are 10 pages. Some of them are just quotidian details about farming. Some are about, you know, complex descriptions of master-slave relationships. And, because just an idea of how vast and strange the enterprise was. You know, you could be a single slave living in a brownstone in Maryland as a house servant. You could be one of two slaves on a small family farm in South Carolina, or one of 120 slaves in the 1850s when cotton and sugar are huge economic engines.
Now, you've mentioned your parents and their civil rights battle. I know that when I was growing up and my parents would tell me about being Jewish, that if the Nazis were to come back, it wouldn't matter how Jewish I was, off I would be taken. And I had a lot of fear and anger. Did your parents need you to write this book? Did it make them proud?
My dad passed away a couple years ago. My mom seems very proud, and I'm glad. I think, you know, I can't imagine being at the March on Washington as they were that day. You know, they're somewhere on the Washington Mall in that picture. I can't imagine what it meant to them. And then to raise four children and hope that they have it better than they had it, all the while knowing that, yes, each time I leave the house, you know, their son leaves the house, they can have a bad encounter with a policeman, or if they go into the wrong neighborhood, as happened to Yusef Hawkins in the 80s, went to Bensonhurst and was beaten to death, things go horribly wrong. So that mixture of hope and despair, I feel it for my kids. What kind of world are they going to grow up into? And then, you know, pulling back, what did my parents envision for their kids and what kind of world they're bringing into? It's mind-boggling.
But later in the book, Cora meets in a classroom children who are practically singing the Declaration of Independence, and not knowing any better, she says, "How'd you teach those pickaninnies to do that?" And the teacher says, "We don't call them pickaninnies here, we call them children." And so all of that sense that a novel is made for, that words are important, that learning the words to use to be a person who cares about other people is crucial to growing up in the world you would like to live in. These are things the book reminds us of. This is such a different realm than the realm of the other books. You were a wise guy before. What happened to you?
Sure. Well, I mean, when I had the idea 16 years ago, I knew that if I tried it back then, I would just mess it up. I was a sort of Gen X slacker. And, I think the first two books are, you know, serious.
They're wonderful books, but they're not like this. You were writing in a different tradition, a kind of postmodern, high modern tradition. This is in the tradition of the question, what makes a democracy? You know, if we stop asking or trying to answer that question, we're in terrible trouble. We need this book, yeah?
No, well, thanks. I mean, I think if you keep at something, you get better. So I kept writing. Hopefully I'm a better writer. I think this is the best book I've done. And if you try to be a larger person in the world, a more empathetic person, you hopefully improve with age. And I think I'm a little older and wiser than I was 16 years ago, and I think that fed the book. So I waited, and I think I waited for the right time.
I have to disagree with you. I don't think it's that it's a better book. I think it comes from a better sensibility. I think, you know, you were reflecting a popular attitude then, which was that in some crazy way, nothing mattered. These people are trying to escape the cotton gin. It's the opposite of the kind of book you once were writing, and I think it's not about being better. I think that a change of view became possible for you, and I'm wondering how.
Can you continue through life with a nihilistic point of view? How productive is it? I think it's useful at different times in your life. Nihilism or realism, you know, whatever you want to call it. I have to have hope for the future. I, you know, have two kids, and I hope that they're going to move into a better world than I was born into. My father used to write poetry in this. He was a businessman. That was his generation's idea of achievement. But he used to write poetry on the side. He was sort of a frustrated poet. And he wrote a poem for me when I was in my mother's womb, something along the lines of, "You were sleeping when I leaned in and apologized for what I was bringing you into." And on the one hand, you're bringing a life into the world, and that's a source of joy and happiness, but also the world works a certain way. And so my outlook on the world has changed, knowing that I've brought two people into it, and I hope that they have it easier than I have had it and their ancestors. And hopefully, if they have children, things will be better for them. And that's a different kind of sustenance. I think there's the sustenance of realism and also the sustenance of hope. And in this or that book, I'm partaking of both.
I've been talking with Colson Whitehead, author of The Underground Railroad, published by Doubleday. Thank you, Colson, for joining me.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Underground Railroad at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to the Radio Foundation studio in New York, and to my assistant David Sobel, and to Michael Goldsmith at Doubleday, who was so helpful. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Affinity Konar is our guest.